travel. You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer. This is a discussion episode where I bring back some familiar guests to talk about a topic in music. And today the topic is humor in music. You're right now, as I am speaking, hearing a song by one of my three guests, Don Ralph, from the band Life in a Blender. I interviewed him for episode 139, and pretty much all of his lyrics are funny. You will also hear from another singer-songwriter, David Heatley, perhaps better known as an animator. And in fact, I have not yet had him on this podcast, but I did bring him on for the discussion of Peanuts, as in Charlie Brown, for Pretty Much Pop. That's Pretty Much Pop, episode 116. Finally, you will hear from Dave Dawson, a.k.a. Diggy Dawson, the author most recently of Pop Idol, I-D-L-E, 30 years on the road as a professional singer. But I spoke to him on Pretty Much Pop, episode 142 from 2023, about his books attributed to Dave Philpott and his father, Derek Philpott, such as Dear Mr. Kershaw and Dear Mr. Popstar, where they would write letters to rock and roll stars, purposefully misunderstanding the content of their lyrics, and they would get these pop stars to reply and include those replies in the book. So it is very funny. To learn more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, or to get these episodes completely ad-free, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. Either way, you will find links to the material by these guests, and I will link to some of the particular songs and artists we discussed throughout this episode, and I will also link there to the unedited video of this discussion if you want to actually see our faces as we get into this topic. All right, here we go. Why, this is Nakedly Examined Music, a very special discussion-based episode bringing together three of my past guests from the various projects from Nakedly Examined Music and or Pretty Much Pop. Let's go through them. Don Ralph from Life is a Blender, remind us what your deal is about.
I've been in a band, Life in a Blender, for decades. It could be almost 40 years now, and we've been playing, and we always did have a sense of humor going through most of our songs. I started out in Poughkeepsie, New York, which naturally is a funny place to start out, I think. And the first song I ever did that sort of got me hooked on the trail was a song called Poughkeepsie City of Sin, which was satirical about the hometown. Although, you know, as we get into this, these are the things about humor I'd love to bring up, because not everybody saw that even the first song is funny when you talk about your hometown. Poughkeepsie's not a city of sin. Why would you think that's funny? Well, it's funny because it's such a boring place. But anyway, so I've been doing this for decades. There's lots of humor, but we have our serious songs too. But obviously, with a name like Life in a Blender, you're going to have a sense of humor running through. So we're very orchestrated often with strings and horns. So I think it's a great topic because you can talk about the music. I feel like that we've done is very serious, but there's a sense of humor that can run through many of the songs. So there you go. There's a little quasi synopsis.
So folks can hear Don's music on my Nakedly Examined Music interview with him from 2021. But then you came out with another album, Bent by the Weather, in 2024, and bugged me and said, hey, you want to feature me again? And I said, well, I don't really do that with this podcast. But this format, this rare thing, is an excuse to bring people back, not to re-examine the songs, but let's just talk about a topic. And the one that I pitched to you was humor in music. So this is what we're going to try to figure out today. David Heatley, who will be a future Nakedly Examined Music guest, but was a past guest on Pretty Much Pop on one of these panels. Refresh folks about what your work is about.
Yeah, so I'm a musician and a cartoonist, and I also direct animation. Yeah, I've been writing songs for at least 30 years and kind of cut my teeth in high school, going to open mics in the East Village, worshipped a lot of bands on this label called Shimmy Disc, several of whom were quite humor-based. This guy, John S. Hall, in a band called King Missile. They were kind of one of my idols at the time, and I got to know them and play some shows with them. But yeah, I live in Maine now, but I spent 20 years in New York City, and I've probably played in three or four bands and recorded about six or seven albums over the years. And I would say I mostly write sort of storytelling songs. So some of those could be funny, but more often than not, somewhere in between serious and funny.
And as far as your professional life goes, are you still more well known for your graphic novel stuff than your music stuff?
I would say so. Although living up here in Maine, it was nice to kind of start fresh and play open mics in Portland where no one has a clue who I am. And so they only know me as a musician. And I'm just actually giving my first lecture about my comics in a couple weeks up here. So that'll be my introduction, that side of my life. But yeah, I'm mostly in these circles up here. I'm kind of known as a songwriter now, which is nice.
All right. And then finally, Dave Dawson, also known as Dave Philpott. We had a pretty much pop discussion focusing on your work with funny letters to musicians and the musicians' responses to them. But you've also written, well, what's the new thing?
I'm writing a book about the books. I'm Dave Dawson. I'm a professional musician doing covers gigs, mainly in sort of dementia units and for elderly people. But what I'm most known for is the pop star letter books. It's a small family thing, and it was done under the names of Derek and Dave Philpott. And we wanted to use pen names as like a mask because we were playing the role of like slightly confused music, not even enthusiasts, just people that listen to the radio and they thought they had the right to write to the artist and say where they'd gone wrong. So we'd say, "Dear Mr. Kershaw, no, I don't want to be in your shoes because I take a size 6 and you take a size 8, so therefore the shoes would be too big, etc., etc." And it was just basically an interactive thing where the pop stars would write back in character, pointing out, you know, where we were right or wrong. It was just like this cottage industry thing, which turned into 4 books, which are still doing very, very well. It's just a bit of fun, really. We're just trying to demonstrate that once, and this will probably kick into what we're talking about today, the main thing is to illustrate to musicians and the public that once a song is released into the wild, the musician then loses all control as to how it's interpreted by the general public. And we were just trying to shine a light on that and have a bit of fun.
And in your cover work, is it straight ahead covers? Is it naughty covers?
It's straight ahead covers. But what's really interesting is I've done this for 15 years. And whereas like 15 years ago, if somebody had asked me for a David Bowie song, I'd have thought they were probably related to them because there was no other reason to ask for it. What I'm finding now is that as I get older and as the audiences get older, I'm now being asked for like 70s and 80s tunes, you know, by people in their sort of 70s and 80s themselves. So it's quite a linear thing in that whereas I used to be asked for Frank Sinatra and Nat King Cole, now it's literally the Pistols and the Clash and Johnny Cash and Steve Harley and Cockney Rebel. So it's a really enlightening job. It's a very rewarding job to have. I feel guilty getting paid for it, really. But there you go.
All right. So the topic of humor in music is vast. You know, as a songwriter myself, I probably have an unhealthy emotional relationship toward life, and I use humor as a coping mechanism. And so when I'm going to write lyrics, why wouldn't you throw in witticisms or irony or something? Like, it's just part of just how I live. And so I feel like it's an honest expression. I did try to write some songs as I was doing the philosophy podcast of like, oh, is there a concept in falsifiability in Karl Popper? I write a song called Falsifiable, and maybe I could become a philosophy novelty act, which would be a very niche thing that could go to all the philosophy conferences. I don't know if it's because I just can't do that I have to just sort of write what the gut tells me to write for the most part. I'm not a craftsman in that way that I could just crank out things according to a formula, but there were some limits to how far humor could go in my music before it sort of felt false or gimmicky or something like that. Don, start us off with you were very excited about this topic. What's your sort of thesis in the area?
Oh boy, this is a tough one. I think one of the points you brought up too is like that you could be a character, and maybe David Heatley there said something similar to that. And like, I have a song, Go To Man, that's about Better Call Saul kind of character that's shyster, you know, he'll sell you tickets to the concert. He'll set you up, and that's the big chorus. I'll set you up, whatever you want. I feel, you know, this is just one aspect of humor songs is that you can adopt a character that's not necessarily yourself, but isn't yourself. And you can present a whole point of view that way as the character, which I think is great. I wish I saw more of it. I feel like I grew up heavily influenced by writers like Randy Newman, Loudon Wainwright, they just had very strong character pieces. Like Randy Newman would have so many great songs from a distinctive voice of like a Southern racist or something like that, and be able to present it and be satirical. I feel like it's a difficult way to do a song sometimes because people will take you literally. If I do a song like Go To Man, where I'm a perspective of I'm the shyster trying to, you know, I'll get you anything you want, but there'll be a price to pay, that people sometimes just take it so literally, you know. So humor is it can be tough to put across because not everybody gets your perspective. So I'm just skipping out there with the Randy Newman, Loudon Wainwright. That's just one facet of humor.
I relate to that. And I've been experimenting with it a little more, this sort of, especially the unreliable narrator. So I have the edgiest song I've written that I've been playing at open mics, and it kills when I play it. It's called Daddy's Little Slut. It came out of this imagined scenario where this guy goes to a strip club and the stripper sort of follows him home and then winds up crashing on his couch. And they get into this dynamic where she's kind of asking to be put on the straight and narrow path. And if she goes out all night, then she should get punished for it. And he's singing it from this point of view of like, poor me. Oh my God, this woman's driving me crazy. What did I get myself into? But it's so clear by the end that he's in on the game and they're both driving each other crazy and it kind of works for them. I was quite nervous playing that for the first time. Then I realized there's a certain way I can put it over in the performance with a little wink, or even just setting up at the beginning, say, okay, everybody, this is not me. This is a character. You know, that sort of helps.
I mean, does it help to sing in a silly voice? That's not the norm, because it's hard to actually be fully expressive. But one of the things, like if you're doing covers, this is what I was asking Dave, if they're naughty covers, you know, that if I do something in a goofy falsetto, like, well, that's in some ways just exploring a different part of my range, a thing that I try to make not every song that I do sound like every other song, but it also is a musical joke. It's connoting Bee Gees. It's connoting something. I mean, disco is just inherently funny at this point. 80s is just inherently funny at this point. Maybe it depends on your generation, but these sort of callbacks to nostalgia. Don, I recall the second track on your new album starts off with sort of a James Brown thing and some kind of disco drums, and like just that by itself seems like a musical joke. I mean, is humor in music? We're talking about like, I told a funny story, but how does the musical aspect, the lyrical aspect relate as far as the humor goes?
We do have a song that's a disco song. I've been involved with this project called the Bushwick Book Club. So we'll write songs about books, and we had a book about bicycles. Since it's just a very innocent type of topic, I said, well, let's make it a disco type of song. And that's probably the song that maybe you're referring to on this latest album that we have out. Yeah, so the music is maybe funny because people respond to disco in a funny way, I guess. But when we play that song live, it goes over very well. People love that beat. They want to hear that disco thing, and it's a nostalgic thing, and somehow it'll strike, I feel like, even younger audiences that might come to see us. They'll feel like, oh, that's funny. I'm not familiar totally with disco, and there's something funny about it.
Yeah, let me just tell them the name of that song. My Heart, Your Sweat Does Feed. So just The fact that it's, it has that sort of classic English phrasing for this bike song.
And the song about Sean Connery, we try to do strings and a mood like a Sean Connery in parts of it. It's very folky song, but then there's a part of it where we try to bring in music that's James Bond soundtrack type of music. So, and then people respond to that because they get there's a little musical joke there. So I can see how the music sometimes can be funny. Although I think like overall, it was hard to me to think of any songs out there in the world. Like, where is a song where the music itself is funny when you brought that up and with some of your notes? So I'd be curious to hear if anyone else knows where's the song where the music itself feels like, whoa, that's striking a humorous chord.
Pop music used to be Tin Pan Alley or the Borscht Belt, or even musical theater is sort of, there's always the funny number in every musical. And there are like little asides from the band. You got the trombone doing its little slide or a certain drum fill that's at the right moment. So yeah, I do think it's narrative, right? And it is when you're writing something funny or performing something funny or having a funny bit in a bigger show staged, I think it is best when the music sort of supports that. There's these dramatic moments where you want the punchline to land or you want the character to fully reveal themselves in the funniest way. I'm not pointing to a particular song, but that's kind of a lineage we have in this country. And I think, Dave, you were saying something similar, like you have your own version of that in the UK.
Yeah, it ties in with I mean, the examples I can think of top of my head is probably Ian Dury is just got it all over his music. Morris has got it as well. But I think it's a callback, certainly with both of those, it's a callback to, we go back to George Formby and we go back to Stanley Holloway. There's a very strong music hall tradition there. I couldn't think of an example when we just spoke just now, but I think that with Alice Cooper, I think he's got a very strong, strong lineage to vaudeville. And I know that when Groucho Marx, who we become really good friends with, the first time that Groucho Marx went to see an Alice Cooper show, and he was told by the press and told by, you know, everybody that it was a hellish horror show, he just went, well, this is vaudeville. And going back to what you're saying about the tunes then, when you hear a song like They're Coming to Take Me Away, My Friends, you know, by Napoleon Bonaparte, whatever it's called, it's a bouncy tune. You know it's going to be funny. But I think it's really cool when you have a straight-up pop song that's not funny, and then the injection of humour into it makes it all the more jarring because you're not expecting it. And an example there I think of is probably The Queen Is Dead by The Smiths, which you're probably familiar with, which is a very dark, dark lyric. And then Morrissey chucks in a reference to the time where this guy broke into Buckingham Palace and sat by the Queen's bedside. And Morrissey injects himself into the character and he says, I broke into the palace with a sponge and a rusty spanner. She said, I know you and you cannot sing. I said, that's nothing. You should hear me play piano. And it's coming from a place where you're not, the rest of the song is dark. And then the fact that he chucks that line in, you kind of almost laugh out loud because it's almost a relief, I suppose, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's just that trigger where you think, yeah, okay. Alice Cooper does it as well in Schools Out. I just think a brilliant line in Schools Out is when he's talking about the school children being uneducated. And he actually says, we can't even think of the words that rhyme because he can't think of a rhyming couplet for that particular line. So he injects that into the song as well. I just love that sort of arch wry, you know, layered humor in music.
Yes.
That's great. It's great to hear about Ian Dury there too. Yeah, I love Ian Dury. His songs are amazing. All the hits, Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick and Reasons to Be Cheerful and all those songs are great.
Madness were heavily influenced by Ian Dury, heavily influenced. And you can hear it in a lot of their stuff as well. And it does go back to that music hall tradition, you know.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if the humor of somebody like Ian Dury is different for us in America, because partly it is the accents. Before we started the recording, we're talking about a Spinal Tap, just that because you live near Stonehenge and they play. And so, you know, Spinal Tap are Americans making fun of Britishness just by doing not terrible British accents, but I don't know. Do they sound terrible to you? Do they sound like Americans?
It's pretty spot on, actually. Except when they shout, they say that if you shout in somebody else's accent, that's when your true voice comes through. And there's certain bits in Tap where Michael McKean's shouting, you think, oh, that's not English. You're not one of us, are you?
I had referred to the humor inherent in disco or something, and I think that's just entirely relative to what the listener's relationship to that kind of music is and what they're trying to do. So like, I find the Rolling Stones doing country songs to be hilarious. And that's sort of how I was introduced to country. Mm-hmm. I wasn't an actual country fan. I'm from the Midwest. I sort of like, oh, that's not my, that's stupid music. That I don't know what exactly I thought. I was very uneducated about it, but actually it ended up being an honest way into it. That it's, you know, from the Rolling Stones being very silly as British people doing bad Southern accents, mm-hmm. making fun of country, but then you start to get country in your soul, and then you hear, you know, real country, and sure. So the line between what is goofy, right? So enjoying disco ironically, or enjoying any sort of throwback music ironically, is only one step away from enjoying it honestly. Like, I don't know that there actually really is a difference. I think people are lying to themselves.
You're making me think of the Beatles, like Rocky Raccoon too. They did plenty of that. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking about too. Yeah.
Old granny music, as John Lennon referred to McCartney's, yeah. Like the granny music is good, but you guys thought you were too cool to like that old granny music. But you know, we get our pleasure where we can. And who's going to say that When I'm 64 is some sort of 30s parody song at this point? No, it's just a nice song.
Yeah. Yeah.
We need to take time out for some ad reads.
which I may be reading ironically. You don't know. It is my greatest wish to tell you about the Surfshark Virtual Private Network. Using a VPN is like wearing pants. All the important stuff stays private and secure. A VPN covers your whole online activity. Once your device connects to the internet, all the information is encrypted. That way, your online activity is hidden from all the snoopers and trackers and ne'er-do-wells. Do you want all the pervy sites that you visit to know exactly who and where you are so they could show up at your house, like in that Adam Sandler movie Punch Drunk Love, and try to extort money from you? No, you value your privacy. Do you want someone stealing your identity so they go and sign up for a dance class and then you go to that dance class to spy on them like in that one Friends episode where Rachel had her identity stolen? No, because you value your security. Well, if you have ever turned your computer on in a cafe, in an airport, in a hotel, you're on public Wi-Fi, and that is especially when you need a VPN. And when you are choosing a VPN, you would want one with, say, over 3,000 servers in 100 countries, 24/7 customer support, the ability to use the VPN on an unlimited number of devices that you own for a surprisingly low cost, access to other services like Surfshark Antivirus and Surfshark Search, which is a private ad-free search engine that provides only organic search results without tracking your activity. And best of all, Surfshark has a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee. Secure your privacy with Surfshark. Go to surfshark.com/nakedly. For 4 extra months of Surfshark. You can find that URL in our show notes.
It's almost refreshing to hear these bands from the 60s, Beatles, Kinks, I think of too. You know, so many songs by the Kinks are funny. Ape Man, Sunny Afternoon, you know, there's satire there, there's humor there. And that music hall touch, I felt like that was part of every British rock album growing up with, that you're going to have that music hall touch, which I found charming. I feel like you don't see it now in a rock band that says, like, we have serious songs, and we'll throw in a bit of a humor too.
Yeah.
I feel like I don't see that today as much.
That's true.
Where you saw Beatles, Kinks, and whoever else.
Yeah. I was just thinking of something you said though, Dave, about, you know, taking a serious song like Morrissey and injecting these moments, or even just the performance of an old standard. Like, one of my favorite singers, songwriter, musicians, Peter Stampfel. And, you know, any one of his songs, he's got this squeaky, kind of ridiculous voice, really. And when he's singing, there's this great version of him singing Haunted Heart, which is kind of this doo-wop song that's none of the lyrics are funny at all. The message is sort of like, stay quiet, my haunted heart, or, you know, be quiet. And at one point he just screams, shut up, haunted heart. You know, it's so like, it's such a jarring, surprising moment. And it is sort of laugh out loud funny. And then also, yet it sort of moves me that this kind of fragile little character with this voice is singing this very touching song, you know. So I actually like things that are not just straight up parody or just here's silly all the way through, but you get this other emotion beyond the laugh where you're kind of, your brain kind of almost doesn't know how to process it. Like, that's my favorite sort of funny moment within a song.
Well, like, what about Mo Tucker when she sings in the Velvet Underground, when you close the door?
Yes.
And that, like, there's something very just spooky and natural about it, but it's kind of like one of those, I'm trying to remember what film directors, but that, you know, use sort of like, I want to use people that don't know how to act. So that they'll just sound very weird, but natural. Pink Flamingo, who's the director?
John Waters.
Yeah.
Yeah, that song is, I mean, that's amazing because it just sounds like some 1970s children TV song or something. But she's singing about like being a drug addict who doesn't want to leave her room and have the night continue forever. It's so dark and it's like she might as well be surrounded by Muppets, how kind of sweet and silly she sounds when she's singing. I know, I love that song too.
I think it's interesting sometimes when, especially Zappa does this a lot, is when the humor is coming from, there's like a vitriolic sense to it, which makes it a bit darker and a bit more spiky. And a key example of that is, I love Money for Nothing. Once you know the story behind Money for Nothing about, you know, Martin Offler being in that white goods store, and he's just writing down what the guy's saying and turns it into a song, just makes it all the more funny for me, you know? And there's that little spikiness. It just seems sometimes that if there's an injection of spikiness or vitriol in it, it just makes it a little bit funnier, especially when you know the backstory. It took me 10 years to know what Money for Nothing was really about, but once you get it, it just all slots in, doesn't it?
Oh, that's so funny. I mean, that song, I remember, so I was working in a carpentry shop in New Jersey in the 90s, I guess it was. And that song would come on the radio and I would say how great it was. And these guys just took it 100% seriously. This singer believes this thing about rock and roll stars and where, you know, I'm a real worker, I'm a real man, whatever. And I was like, he is that rock and roll star. He's got Sting on that song. What are you talking about? It's just amazing to me that they couldn't see the unreliable narrator quality of that song. But of course it's there, you know.
With metal as well, I'm a massive metal head. And sometimes, because somebody spoke to Steve Harris and said, do you really believe all this devil stuff? No, of course I don't. It's just vaudeville. It's just showbiz, you know.
Yeah.
But sometimes I wonder, with some of those metal bands, whether they're serious or whether they're just playing into the role, you know. Sometimes it's so blurred that it's so well done that you don't know if they believe it or not themselves, you know. I mean, how can you possibly take a song like Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter seriously when you say to your daughter, where are we going? We're going to get some chips. No, I thought we'd go to the slaughter, love. Get your bags. Come on, we're going to the slaughter.
Yeah. Or how about the backward satanic messages on records? Like, yeah, they're seriously trying to program teenagers to be their slaves.
They interviewed Jimmy Page on that at the Oxford Union. He said the songs are hard enough to write forwards without putting stuff backwards.
Well, so how much can you commit to the bit? Like, if you're saying that metal is some kind of ironic, humorous pose, well, generally, it comes with a uniform that people continue to wear through their lives. Many of them, you know, some of them eventually cut their hair short or whatever, but you can't really think like, oh, this is actually all ridiculous, but yet I'm going to feel comfortable on a daily basis grooming my long, luscious hair, whatever the metal, you know, with my 12 nose rings or whatever the thing is. It at least has to be blurred. Like, yes, I don't take myself too seriously, and that's healthy. But I think this is a cool style.
Mm-hmm. When I saw Metallica at Donington in about 85, they were just breaking in this country. So it was around the time of Ride the Lightning. It's exactly what you just said. The rest of the bands were all in like the poodle hair and the spandex and the leopard skin. Metallica just looked like us. They looked just like the people in the crowd. And James just said, if you're here to see Hairspray and Poodle, this is the wrong effing band, you know? And that was real to me. And then you see these other bands, you know, doing these horrible parodies and they're trying to be serious afterwards, trying to justify what they're talking about seriously. Yeah, yeah.
That's where Spinal Tap comes in, yeah.
Yeah, and also, but I think Steel Panther do it just as well, if not better. I thought they were real when they came out, Steel Panther. And they've got the chops as well. They can play, can't they? They're all session players in other bands, aren't they?
Well, it's interesting, though, when you said how much you commit to the bit, you know, and how much does it become a persona that you walk around all the time in. I guess none of us sees that metalhead, like, in his bedroom, in his bathrobe, or his casual sweatpants around the house. Like, there's...
Well, the Osbournes sort of did
yeah,
that.
Yeah, well, that's true, that's true. But I was just going to say, I think all my favorite musicians have found a way to be some sort of persona. So Bob Dylan is like a very specific persona, very, you know, several personas throughout his career and fully committed to it. And he writes and sings from that perspective. Or someone like Jonathan Richman, even, he's just like, hey, I'm just this naive guy. And I sing right from my heart and I barely revise. And first time I write it, here it is. And Lou Reed, where he comes out of that influence, like, it doesn't always have to be a funny persona, but that is, I think, the way into being a, you know, an iconic sort of musician. You kind of think of them almost as an archetype rather than just a person, you know?
I think Jonathan Richman's a great example there as an archetype. For him, I feel like I can't imagine him being any other way behind the scenes. I feel like he's organic. He's just such an original voice. And when I first heard him, I thought, is this funny or not? I didn't understand it. It was because his voice didn't sound very musical. But then when you get into it, you really embrace it because he's a true original.
Yes.
And there are songs that are outright funny, like Ice Cream Man and Abominable Snowman in the Supermarket. And then there's ones that have more like, I don't know, they're funny, but have a poignancy to them, of course, where he's very open with his heart.
Yes.
Talking about love and going to a lesbian bar and really appreciating
it. Yeah. Or she doesn't laugh at my jokes or, you know.
Yeah.
But even, when he was at his most straight, which he now makes fun of now, this kind of like, he says, we were playing like Trip Hammers and the Modern Lovers and we needed to loosen up. You know, his big song, I'm Straight, it's like Hippie Johnny. Like Hippie Johnny is just a silly name, a silly phrase. Like there's jokes even in that song. You know, it's not a serious straight song.
The live version of the Ice Cream Man on Jonathan Richmond Live is that just never ends.
Yeah.
That's the joke. Is that, one more time. Yeah, and until it just, you know, it becomes annoying and then becomes funny again. It's just one of those old humor techniques.
Totally.
I love that. Yeah, that really makes it super funny that it goes on forever.
Well, what's funny about the end of that too is that people are still cheering for more, and he just goes, finally, he's like, forget it. Or, you know, whatever he says, like, I'm done. The bit is over. But they wanted like 10 more times, apparently.
I just thought of actually a heavy rock metal act that really are aware of what they were doing, and it's more rock than metal. But I mean, you just said Ice Cream Man. It's just like, if we listen to, I think the song's called Ice Cream Man. It's on the first Van Halen record. Dave Lee Roth is a man that's totally in control of where the humor line is, you know?
Yeah.
And it's all the funnier for it, even if he doesn't try to deceive people. I mean, that song is disgusting if you actually read it with the real double entendres in there. It's really, really quite... that's where Jury goes back. The madness go back to Max Miller. Max Miller's lyrics were disgusting, but it's what he didn't say. Like Hitchcock, it's what he didn't say, and then he lets you imagine it. There's actually far worse, and but it's still got on the radio, you know?
Yeah.
Leaving stuff out, and so it's far worse.
So I wonder if a real band is playing songs that are like Spinal Tap Big Bottoms, and this becomes a thing that you just have to do again and again. Do jokes in songs get older than other songs? I mean, no artist really wants to play their big hit again, you know, that everybody requests, right? And that's the only song that they know by them, and they have to play it again and again and again, and many of them just like refuse or you know, that's at least a live issue. But if it's a joke song, if it's actually something that you find offensive, but you just thought this was a funny joke, is it still a funny joke when you have to do it 40 years later for the umpteenth time? It seems like that is a kind of thing like the costume that would wear on you, that I could see why artists would want to change to maybe not do those same jokes.
Well, I'm a big rap fan too, and you make me think of, like, you know, Sir Mix-a-Lot, I like big butts and I cannot lie. And, you know, of course, I'm sure he played that a million times, but there's this one recording of him playing with some like full symphony orchestra. Have you seen this thing? And there's like, the women are taking it seriously, and then they're playing the strings, and then they get up and they're all shaking their asses at the end of the song. It's just like, that's a way to keep it playing it for 30 years and like take it to that next level. And so you don't get sick of it.
I haven't heard that, but I do really, really like the Jonathan Colton version of that song, if you are familiar with that. So he's sort of a novelty, internet-y kind of act. And I like big butts and I do not lie. Some other brothers can't deny. And it's a pretty, pretty guitar backing and thing, but he just does the whole song like that. And so folk versions of rap songs, I think, is a way that, you know, it's not funny music per se, but it's the juxtaposition.
For sure.
Clearly, you know, that's what I just mean by the naughty covers, that I appreciate when somebody repurposes a metal tune in a different style, or, you know, what any kind of transposition like that.
Was Richard Cheesebig over where you are? Was it just in this country? He was an American parody artist just doing lounge covers of Nirvana. And it was, right. Do you know him? It's really... And you get to hear the lyrics for the first time because he's doing it as a crooner, you know?
Yeah.
What about They Might Be Giants? That must be a prime contender for this.
Sure. My thesis about that band, they were a big influence on me in like middle school. They were my first band I ever saw actually live. I like John Linnell. To me, he writes the poignant songs, even when they're funny. They hit you in the heart, and they're quite sad, a lot of them. And John Flansburgh is kind of the better kids artist. And when I had kids, we listened to the They Might Be Giants children's album. And so he can just be sort of the goofy, funny guy and lead with that. And kids love it. But his stuff is not quite as interesting for me or layered as Linnell in the more straight version of the band or grown up version of the band. I think Linnell is actually quite an amazing lyricist. Actually, he's absurd and surreal, but he's also, it's really poignant, a lot of those songs, you know?
I've heard that they do not like to categorize, like, is this a funny song? Is this a, like, that's, it's just, it's the way that they come out. It's the way that they are able to generate a lot of material is by, you know, you were talking about telling story songs. Yeah. It's basically a literary move. Well, this might be more Dadaist or something. Like, we're just going to draw semi-random, silly images and put them together. And I've had people in my bands that refer to my own lyrics as, like, I don't think that I'm doing what they're doing. I think what I'm doing is much more personal and understandable, but I can see where that might come from.
I think that's a barrier for a lot of people listening to them, to be honest, because they do have a novelty music gloss to a lot of what they do, and it puts some people off. But if, you know, if you can get past that, there is a lot of richness there.
But there's also minimum wage. And then they play a lot of some lounge music. That's a good little joke.
Or fingertips, right? Yeah.
I can't think of any examples where it's a funny lyric, but I mean, the B-52s are inherently funny, aren't they? Although I can't think of a single lyric that is funny, but I love that, you know, buying into the B-movie thing and, you know, and it's amazing. I can't think of a single funny lyric, but you just, there's something inherently funny about them.
Yeah, well, how about Fred just going, Love Shack Baby?
Yeah.
That's funny.
The thing about a rock lobster, you know, that is inherently funny.
So I guess we're kind of exploring the edge of what's camp and what's funny, and camp is clearly like a very LGBT comes out of that tradition. And it's not just like a parody, though. It's kind of creating this surreal, dreamy space where the rules of the rest of society don't apply or something. I don't know how to articulate exactly, but camp does feel just a little bit different from straight up humor to me.
I always thought Cheap Trick were funny. I mean, they did a song called, is it them that did I Love You Honey, But I Hate Your Friends?
I don't know that one.
Sure. But the Cheap Trick, their whole image of having the two rock star people and then the two, say, nerdy, you know, and the drummer smoking a cigarette with a mustache and the guy with the baseball cap like this playing guitar. I mean, that's just has a sense of humor going through it from their look.
Yeah. And they're a great live band.
What about Devo? I found them, you know, they're funny, but they're so distinctive. But again, I guess, are they slightly campy? But they embrace their whole image, they have a whole concept, which I find funny, but the music's serious.
Yeah, I had them in my second book. We wrote to Gerald, and I pretended to think that Whippet was about a greyhound. And he bought into it completely. Absolutely. He flawed the reply. Because when we do the letters, the idea is to make the reply funnier than the letter. We used to say, you know, the letters are the bread, but the replies are the jam. And Gerald just came back. I loved it when the artists used to come back in character, you know, and they come back in their public persona. He was amazing. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Very funny. Yeah. He's a very funny man. Yeah.
I've had Jerry on this show and they take their mission very seriously. He does specifically. I think he's really the guy that's sort of pushing the, like, Mothersbaugh, maybe more the aesthetic of the goofy synth sounds and his pointy voice and things. But Jerry is really committed to this idea of critiquing the monstrous way that people behave and are being corrupted by commercialism and all that kind of stuff. And so it is one of these ironic poses that is their bread and butter. And like, they've had to do it for so many years that I wonder if this is not, I would get weary. And I know he switched it up and he like did another character, like as this sheik, you know, who did like terrorism songs. Like, you look this up, you know, in the last 20 years, some of his solo stuff. So yeah, he's a student of conceptual humor, a really interesting case. We should talk more about Zappa, Dave, you'd brought him up because, you know, this is he's so polarizing in this way, just these really foul songs, the Catholic girls and the put a spindle up my butt till it makes me scream. These. Yeah. What do we think?
A lot of this depends on the age you were. All right. So when I heard Suicide Chump as a kid, I was 14, I think it was. And there was a guy that I knew and he brought me into Stars and Angel and Sammy Hagar and Cheap Trick and Blue Oyster Cult, but he always used to put a Zappa song on the end just to freak me out, you know. The first time I heard Suicide Chump, I thought as a kid, is this allowed? It can be quite damaging if you hear this stuff too young, you know.
Yeah, I think I'm probably got more exposed to the people who grew out of that, because I don't know a lot of Zappa, to be honest. And every time I've tried to dip into an album, I'm just like, not my thing. But for me, a huge band in middle school was like the Dead Milkmen. And like, of course, they're drawing from some of that absurdity and edgy, in your face, you know, angry humor.
I think it's very easy to make funny punk music. I mean, the Ramones themselves, like, they are real punk.
Yeah.
But they're also a self-parody. I didn't know for a long time, like, are these guys really smart or are they really stupid? Like, I still am not completely sure, despite having like read Dee Dee's autobiography but there's something about punk specifically.
Comedy punk is massive over here. Mm-hmm. Do you know a band called the Toy Dolls?
No.
Check that out. Just check it out. It is just brilliant. It's a massive commodity over here, comedy punk. And it's nice because it's punk, you just get every third or fourth word and know it's funny. So then you have to come and look at the lyric sheets and
I was just going to say, one of my friends and favorite musicians, Jeffrey Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
He has this great song called, like, The History of Punk on the Lower East Side. And it goes through, you know, every movement and talks about the Ramones. But his phrase is, back when dumb on purpose became the new smart, which I love.
That's great.
Because I think a lot of punks were in on the joke. For sure.
Do you know the Anti-Nowhere League?
Of course. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. I was thinking about humor, where they go, I F this, I F that, I even F the schoolgirl's cat. So what? So what? So bloody fucking what?
Metallica did a great cover of that as well.
It's almost Spinal Tap in a way. Spinal Tap punk almost.
Oh, no, it's brilliant. One of my best friends is Bruce Thomas from The Attractions. And when that record came out, actually, the police, the Vice Squad, raided the label. And Stiff Records were next door, and Anti-Nowhere League said, look, we're about to get raided. Can we put all this vinyl in your office and you can pretend it's one of your bands instead so they won't come to your office? But he said that they used to drive around in this transit van, and it was spray painted on the side, we're the Anti-Nowhere League and you're not. So they're spiting you even when they're driving around.
I love it.
Did anybody else actually go through a Zappa phase? That I felt like I was very into prog rock, and so this was at least a thing that I got through most of his catalog. And he is somebody that authentically has musical gestures that are supposed to be, I hope they're supposed to be funny, because there's no excuse otherwise for the amount of xylophone that he has in so many songs. Like, yeah. just has a nice melody and then like, oh, let's go off and like, either this is just completely tasteless or it's funny.
Yeah.
And it's so precise and, you know, it's amazing. I saw his son just play in the spring out here in Seattle. And just that they're playing note for note. And the son would say, real mega fans of Zappa were at this concert. And the son would go to the audience and say, this is exactly how my father played Yellow Snow on September 9th, 1972. And they play it note for note exactly from a live recording. And the mega fans, you know, 99% dudes, were, you know, all like, you know, nodding their heads going, wow, this is amazing. You know, the fact that all that precise music, the xylophone, it's amazing. It's great. The music's off the charts and great and funny because it's so preposterously over the top.
Mm-hmm. I think it's funny there, Mark, because I'm a prog head as well. I'm prog obsessive, but there's not much humor in prog. There's hardly anything I can think of that's funny about prog, but the actual artists are really, really, really funny. You know, it's as if it's like they've suppressed it in the music. So they have to be funnier in real life. They're really articulate and witty people. But I can't think of a single prog song at the moment that's funny.
Harold the Barrel.
Come on.
Old Genesis.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I stand corrected. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That they would do some sort of symphonic sort of thing. But then he had the vaudeville thing, I think, really. Peter Gabriel at that point.
Yeah, and the funniest thing about that song is the bloke's threatening to throw himself off a building, and all his mum is worried about is she says, your shirt's all dirty, and there's a man here from the BBC, like as if to say, if I don't want you to fall off the building and have dirty clothes on, because that looks that makes me look a bad mother.
That's great.
But yes, that is a type of music that is known for its taking itself too seriously, being pretentious. And you couldn't say that about Zappa, because even though did all that out there stuff musically, he was so self-debasing. I want to say self-deprecating, but I think self-debasing in terms of what he would do lyrically, and like, oh, I'm going to do a whole album that's like silly doo-wop songs. And so like that, he clearly was just having fun with it. And that was his personality. That was his way of dealing with reality. So I think this was, though it was an act, it was a natural extension of just who he was.
Sure. Isn't there some footage of him like testifying before Congress too about obscenity? And he's just like really smart and really sharp and just dismantles everyone's arguments. I mean, this is a serious dude too. It's not every part of life was a joke to him.
When the PMRC took the dead Kennedys to task, and like Jell-O Biafra just dismantled them with intellect, yeah. You know?
Yes.
That was a great example. The bloke was just absolutely off the chart, you know?
Yeah, because they've carved out a space where they're allowed to be irreverent, envelope-pushing, dirty, and then they defend that space vociferously and very articulately. Like, it is a stance towards the world and free speech and whatever. It's dead serious on some level.
I guess I want to get back to the songwriting aspect sort of as a semi-final topic. Maybe we could still name other things that we feel we want to name check here. But is humor healthy even as an emotional coping method? Like, I just wonder, in writing songs, like, is this why do you feel disrespected if you've written kind of a funny song of like, well, why don't you just actually express your emotions? Why don't you actually just be honest that the humor is a way of keeping things purposefully shallow in a certain, you know, or I want to use the persona. Like, sometimes it can be a way of getting deeper into something, but often it's not.
When we do our books, okay, it's done in character, it's done with a mask on. The reason why we did that rather than do it as ourselves is if you're hiding behind a mask or a persona, you can go to a spot where your normal self would say, no, we have to stop. But because you have a nom de plume or you have a persona, you then take that as your starting point to then just blow it up and be as ridiculous as you like, because it's not you. It's an overblown version of you. That's what I think about that.
Well, I think of it like stand-up comedians. Like, their job in a lot of ways is to tell the truth to society in a way that they can hear it, and it's really uncomfortable and you see yourselves in it. And I think really sharp, edgy humor and music can have the same effect. It's like goes down a little easier because it's sort of makes you laugh, but there's something uncomfortable that like stays in your gut if it's done well.
And I think I'm boring in real life, so if I can adapt on a character for a song, it feels much more exciting than I am. So I'm going to bring a character to the song and try to do something.
Has that just always been the way it's been? Or is it like when I talked to David Lowery, my very first episode for this podcast, I think he's done more character creating songs as he went on, because as a young person, you have all this angst and this stuff that you're dealing with. And as an older person, like, well, what are you going to write about? Mm-hmm. Like, so you might as well create some elaborate story, whether it's a serious dramatic story or it's a detailed conceptual joke or some sort of semi-philosophical just weirdness. So yes, you can use humor as one of the elements to make what you're bothering to write about more interesting. I guess I do definitely feel that's one of the ways I use it in mine. But do you ever feel like it is substituting? Is it a damper for? Is it ever negative in terms of shielding you from real expression? Or is that even what you might be criticized of, you know, by people who don't appreciate your silly lyrics?
There are colors in a palette that you're creating something with. So if everything's always like a Christmas tree lit up and, you know, every color and garish, and it might get to be a bit much. And I do like artists who can kind of layer in, you know, different moods. But if I go to a campy drag show and the person wants to just get serious and tearful at the piano, I'd be a little bit like, what the hell's going on here? You know? So there's a place for that sort of delightful play on the surface, and we all get to escape a bit.
I mean, I was connecting that with what Dave just said about using a character to be able to go to extremes. So I was just at a Riot Fest in Chicago a couple of weeks ago. And so Camper Van Beethoven was at it. In fact, there's a whole stage that was Weird Al curated. So I actually didn't stay around for Weird Al. I'd been there 6 hours and I couldn't take anymore. But it was one of the things he had was like Mac Sabbath.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing.
They play Black Sabbath covers, but they change the lyrics to make them sort of fast food critique of consumerism related. And they dress up, you know, literally the Ronald McDonald doing the Ozzy voice and a Grimace playing bass and a Slayer McCheese with the big burger head and horns, devil horns coming out of it. Like it, they really commit to that bit, but they're basically just a pretty darn good Black Sabbath cover band. And it's, I think just, you know, as we were saying about metal, like punk is just inherently funny in a certain way so that you could just take it to extremes. And the fact that you're doing this weird character means that, no, I'm not, even if I don't know enough about Black Sabbath. I never saw them live to know how seriously they took themselves, but these guys can see how you could really enjoy that kind of music, but yet still not take it seriously.
Yeah. I'm thinking about GWAR as you said that.
Right. GWAR is another. Remember, Dred Zeppelin reminds me of that.
Same
thing. They would do what? Reggae, Elvis, Zeppelin.
Right, right. Or how about the Squirrels in Seattle, right? Do you know the Squirrels?
No, I don't. No, I should.
They're one of these earliest mashup kind of bands where they'll do, like an Elvis version of some serious ballad or rock ballad or something. And really wonderful combinations of, and a really tight band to pull it off too. But anyway. Similar.
Just that, these conceptual bands, it's almost like they have one joke. Well, maybe not the Squirrels, but, you know, these other bands have one joke. GWAR, but they're a great joke. And you embrace
one. Yeah.
You haven't been to P. Lander Z at all, that band? They're Japanese-American. They wear big headdresses, and they have a concept, and they're funny. But I just got to tell you, this one anecdote about seeing them that I found totally funny was that they end their show, when I saw them live, they end their show, they're all playing, and the bass player points out to the audience, and a random person, obviously not a plant, and points at him and says, come up and play my bass. You know, he's gesturing, play my bass. So this random person comes up, he puts the bass over him, and that guy starts playing bass, but he doesn't know what the hell he's doing. So the band starts to disintegrate by having the bass player be somebody totally random. But one by one, they each do it, and they each leave the stage. And by the end of the night, you just have five random people playing total noise, and they don't know what they're doing, and they never come back. The lights go up. Wow, that I thought, that's great.
That's genius.
Yes, the first band that was playing when I got to Riot Fest was Shonen Knife. So that the funniness of punk, but it's like little girl Japanese voices. Of course, they're not little. I'm sure they're in their 40s or whatever by now. But like it has that fun. Just the line between fun and funny, I've never seen as a sharp one. Maybe it's just the way that I take humor. It doesn't, you know, if there's a funny song, it's not like you're laughing out loud at it, especially the ninth time you've heard it. But it engages some part of the brain that is relevant to humor. Let's put it that way.
I'm a massive Fall fan. I just worship them. And sometimes it's just the idea of a song. The fact that Mark E. Smith has sat down and just thought, today I'm going to write a song called Oswald Defense Lawyer. It's funny before you even hear it, you know, and that when you do hear it, it's even funnier. You know, sometimes the concept of the song, the fact that you think somebody sat down and said, I'm going to do that. And that's just as funny as the actual content.
Mm. All right, Dave, let's start us finishing off by plugging your new book. Is it out yet? Or when is it coming out?
It's not finished.
Oh, it's not finished yet. We'll plug your old books.
Okay, so the first book is Dear Mr. Kershaw, named after Nick. And the second book is Dear Mr. Popstar. And we've got, American wise, we've got Chris Butler from The Waitresses, who's like a dear friend of mine. We've got Devo in there. The Americans really love what we do because it just reinforces the quintessential English stereotype of that mad bloke, you know, like the Monty Python-esque sort of thing. So the American, we've got the Knack in there, and they really, really got it. But the other two books, we've got a punk one and an indie one, but they're the two main crossovers, is Dear Mr. Kershaw and Dear Mr. Popstar. And I've got a book coming out next year. The whole premise of the concept is I used to play my dad records, And this is quite interesting, actually, because I'm obsessed by music, as you are, okay? All of us listen to music completely differently from people that don't listen to music, okay? So whereas I listen to Paint It Black, I would be thinking, that's the same pen that bought us Sympathy for the Devil. That's the same pen that bought us Exile on Main Street. My dad would just say, he sees a red door and he wants to paint it black. Well, your uncle tried that and he didn't have a strong undercut on it. And it turned out purple, you know. So it's the whole thing about disassociating yourself from the reverence of the artist and talking about the lyric in isolation. And that's what we do. But the new book is called Peckish Like the Panda. And the reason why we called that is because my dad listened to Hungry Like the Wolf. And he went, why is he, he said, why is he isolating starvation to wild dogs? Why can't it be famished like the ferret or peckish like the panda? And I thought, that's the title. That's
wonderful.
David Heatley, promote something.
I guess the best thing people could do is just follow me on Instagram as I work on various things that are not coming out anytime soon. So it's Heatley, H-E-A-T-L-E-Y. Just Google me and you'll find it's kind of like, you know, having a pass to my art studio and my, you know, recording studio. As I'm working things up, I might post some stuff. But yeah, I do have some older things on Bandcamp and I have a few books that have been published. If you look in the places you buy books, you can find my graphic memoirs and various things.
Don, the new album, excellent. Say more about it. Or what, are you already working on another one?
Working on another one, bit by bit, scrap by scrap. The new album, I still call it new, even though it's a year old, Bent by the Weather. You can go to lifeinablender.net. We have a million records over the decades. The first record, I want to go back to Dave Dawson there and say Chris Butler produced our very, very first record. I always loved The Waitresses from high school on, you know, and I thought that and they could be a whole part of this show too, because The Waitresses are great. Funny. And Chris wrote all the music for the lead female singer. And I mean, all the lyrics and music and great stuff. Anyway, I diverted there back to The Waitresses, but we're working on new music, but we have Bent by the Weather out there and it's get everything at lifeinablender.net.
All right. Excellent. I'll promote my own music, marklint.bandcamp.com. I actually do have my first album since 2018 that should be done before the end of the year. We'll see. It's mostly recorded. And just got to do all the mixing and things. Thanks so much to all of you for coming on and talking through this with me. I think this is a lot of fun. I'm glad to introduce you to each other and to the world.
It's your pleasure. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Good talk for another 3 hours on this.
All right. Thanks for listening, listeners. Thanks for watching. This is on YouTube if you're just listening. If you want to see our lovely faces, I want to leave you today with a song David Heatley chose. It's from his latest album, 2023's If, called Blowing Off the World. So long, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
1, 2. 1, 2, 3. Blowing off the world. I'm busy blowing.
a smart house built on diamonds. See, yeah, it's sunny out, but I can't be reached, cause there's still a loss between me and the beach. I got a crossword puzzle, this book's the best. How about a solitary game of chess or solo scrabble that never ends? Yeah, you could call it worse without friends. I'd consider this day a success if I could just safely dodge the stress you're trying to pile on me. Sorry, I'm busy blowing off the world. I'm busy blowing off the world. I'm busy blowing off the world. I'm busy blowing off the. You wanna talk to me? Sorry, I'm busy.
Oh,